the world. And the bottom line is this, is we as a state will step up at the international level if in fact Washington steps down. And it looks like they are stepping down, so we will move forward ahead. It is really important that we forge ahead with other like-minded countries and subnationals, not just hemispherically, but throughout the world, whether it is in Pacific, the Pacific Rim, whether it's in Africa, whether it's in Europe, Eastern Europe. We need to move forward because we have no other choice, because this is not a scientific issue. All the Nobel Prize winners, all of the climate science, scientific researchers have clearly said this is not sustainable. This is a political issue. It is a leadership issue, and it's a lack of leadership from Washington. So we have no other choice but rather to step up and move forward.
Kevin DeLeon, we want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Sacramento as your governor. Governor Brown is in China. Kevin DeLeon is president pro tem of the California State Senate. And that does it for our broadcast. If you want to read the transcript or get the video or audio podcast, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Stelly. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Exploring Asian American and African American relations.
Throughout most of history, Asian Americans and African Americans have not stood up with each other. We need to recognize that those instances when Asians and African Americans and other people of color have risen up together are exceptional moments in U.S. history.
Crossing East Relations, a new one-hour documentary by Dima Roberts, Tuesday, June 6th at 11 a.m. on KBOO, Portland.
After an investigation of the treatment of prisoners at the Oregon State Penitentiary, the Oregon Department of Corrections agreed to improve conditions. Yet, 1 year later, prisoners with serious mental illness continue to be held in solitary confinement. Join us on Prison Pipeline, June 5th, to hear the Disability Rights Oregon report, Behind the 11th Door, 1 year later. That's Prison Pipeline, June 5th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Big Pharma, Market Failure, on Friday, June 9th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Corporate CEO Richard Master will speak with his new documentary, which focuses on the dynamics behind the escalating cost of pharmaceuticals in the U.S. and the impact of soaring healthcare costs on U.S. businesses, working families, and our overall economy. The screening will be followed by comments and Q&A session with Dr. Richard Masters. Again, that's Big Pharma Market Failure on Friday, June 9th at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Today is Monday, June 5th, 2017, and I am Cecil Prescott.
I am Celeste Carey, and welcome to your community connection, KBOO Portland. 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 if you are in Points East along the Columbia River Gorge, and in the Willamette Valley, it's 104.3. Where is it? Everywhere else.
Everywhere else it can be, KBOO.FM.
All right, I'll work with that.
And this is More Talk Radio.
Yes, indeed. Well, good morning. I haven't had a chance to hang with you in a while. Circumstances have prevented. I believe that's the phrase used.
Circumstances have prevented. It has been a while, and it's great to connect up with you.
Yes.
And to it's been a while, and a lot has happened in our world. I mean, one thing is that, you know, I wake up every morning and say, what has number 45 tweeted in the morning?
I used to feel that way, and I used to check all of the news sources that I had at my availability, via the internet and what have you. And then at some point, I decided to disconnect from that because I realized that not only was it not doing anything to improve my outlook, it was actually posing a challenge, you know, for me to maintain positivity. But more importantly, it was distracting from matters at hand in my more immediate world.
Yes.
You know, the world in which I lived and breathed and moved as a person of color, you know. And some folks would say, well, how could that be such an immediate issue? And I would say, well, if you are a person of color, you already understand that. It's one of those givens. It's one of those things that comes from belonging to a particular group. Just like there are certain things that men experience that women just don't. Certain things that women experience that men just don't. Certain things that, tall people versus short people. And I don't mean in a confrontational or antagonistic way. Just, you know, the differences in perspectives, things that happen. And you recognize that there are certain design overlays that you can't get away from.
That is certainly true. And one thing, you know, there's a couple of things that have been on my mind most immediately, and one we won't particularly talk about today, but it's I think is something that everyone should be aware of and concerned in terms of addressing. And that was the president decision, I think it was this weekend. It's always like something always new happening with this president, to withdraw from the
Paris Accords.
Paris Accords.
Last week.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And more immediately, I reflecting on your statements in terms of more immediate concerns, and that was that here in Portland, the tragedy that evolved within the last 10 days or so in terms of the white supremacist attack on people and the neighborhoods, communities' responses to yet another flare-up for people of white nationalist sentiments and action in our most immediate environment.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because I've been reading comments that come from publications over in the UK, over in Europe, as well as abroad, well, I should say more remotely nationally, you know, other places in the country, and in reference to what happened here in Portland. Now, I'm not in the metro area per se anymore. I'm much further out now, and so it gives me a chance to kind of pause and reflect over what's going on in the city, in the metro area. And then also reading these articles gave it this oddly detached atmosphere, you know, of how everybody felt about both the assault that the young women endured as well as the fatal attacks on the men who came to their defense. And I'm thankful for that distance, because I found myself being yet again triggered, you know, in trying to deal with processing that on a personal level of how I would feel as a young woman if I was in a situation like that, and who do I look to? How do I withstand this kind of abuse? And what I would like to do today is to take some time with people and try to work through a discussion of this that allows us to keep channels of communications open between people, but to not ignore the fact that this is a terrible tragedy to the families and friends of the men who are no longer with us, but it's an ongoing tragedy in a real day-to-day moment for folks of color, and how we as human beings that are existing in this city can value the fact that those men's lives matter, but also black lives still matter, and how to have that discussion so that it does not become an either or, and we can keep the communication in a positive and helpful vein without having to figure it's going to be an either or. You know, it's not a dichotomy, but you cannot suddenly cross out Black Lives Matter because these very valiant men have lost their lives, because this is still a day-to-day struggle unto death for a lot of folks of color. So we need to be able to see each other's perspectives without devaluing each other's perspectives. What are your thoughts on this as we get ready to lead into this and give folks the phone number?
Well, I thought it was helpful that you mentioned in terms of the realities of people of color in our region, and the fact that the reality is that we live under siege daily, and it's something that our reality differs from the white community, and the fact that this sudden outburst of white nationalist violence
say renewed, not sudden, because it's always been there, I believe, with social media and such, yada.
Yeah, I was going.
Oh, okay. My bad.
Yeah. The outburst of white nationalism violence is remind people of the historic realities of this region and the day-to-day challenges that people face. I was certainly I cannot imagine the terror that those two girls faced, but it only reminded me of the terror that many of people continue to face. Over the last couple of weeks, I was in a lot of different environment, mm-hmm. and the reality of that people of color, newer immigrants face, is something that is as you mentioned, is historic, and we have to learn how to take care of ourselves, because ultimately, we cannot rely on the generosity of the larger community. But this recent attack allow us to once again begin to have, I hate this conversation, but in terms of, you know, where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just wearied.
I'm so weary that it's having, you know, here's an interesting anecdote that kind of might shed some light on the kind of energy that people of color have to deal with and why we want to have this conversation. And I'll call it, rather than where do we go from here, how do we keep going and talking together, you know? I was dealing with some, I'm just going to call it stress because there's no adjective to explain how incredible it was. And in the process of trying to maintain self-care, one of the things, you know, you do is you give an inventory of really heinous things that happened to you in life, and then they determine whether or not you're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, yada, yada. Okay, so in the course of it, you know, I've got a caregiver looking at me with, you know, this horrified look, thinking, you survived that. It's like, well, it doesn't seem much like much in comparison to some of my friends, and they go, no, this is your life. You know, and okay, yes, this is your reality. Yet when you go before quote unquote official caregiving institutions, they disallowed that diagnosis, if you will, of post-traumatic stress disorder, saying that, well, it's not life and death issues. Now, I raised a barely existent eyebrow at that and said, well, you know, you can say that now. You weren't there. It was one of those had to be there moments. But yes, it was life and death for me. So, I mean, you know, the outcome could have been I live and breathe and I'm telling you about it. I'm dead. I'm history. So, you know, I found that really interesting that I'm sitting up here listening to this white man give me an assessment that basically denied the reality of everything I had experienced. So not only did I have to allow myself to be re-triggered to go through this process to get some care, but then I had to have some place to put that indignation and anger that somebody's going to tell me, oh, it's just a splinter. You know? And so these are the kinds of ongoing traumas that make this whole situation one of those where you're hearing more and more voices of folks of color coming to the surface and saying, again, yes, these men did a very valiant thing and we will honor them. However, do not think that this in any way changes the situation from our day-to-day ongoing, my God, is it still happening, struggle.
So we would like to include some of your voices and your views. So we encourage you, and I'll have asked Celeste to phrase it in a question that people can respond to. So as much as possible, we can remain on point.
Yes, please.
But give us a call here at your community radio station. And our numbers are
503-231-8187. This is your chance to call in. These are the ground rules. Stay on point. Okay, I'm going to pose a question. I don't want to hear about how the economy is fueling all this, okay? I'm not going to listen to it. As you know, there are times that I will just say, I thank you for your call, goodbye. You know, I'm not as nice as Cecil sometimes. It might be because I'm a few years older. Increased duration of exposure.
Okay.
But you know, what we want to talk about is this. Those men's lives matter. Anyone who has given their life to protect, you know, the rights of a human being, especially with regard to racism and bigotry's life matters. Okay. That is not off the table. However, I want to insist that we listen to this, and this is kind of that restorative justice thing. You listen, you know, Black lives matter, period. There is no qualifier. Okay, how do we keep down the path together, keep conversation going, keep listening and validating each other when we keep both of those ideas foremost in our thoughts, hearts, and minds? So that's where the conversation is. Maybe you have experienced something like this. You know, I have. I've had some of my white friends and white family members be defensive in my behalf, you know, not unto death, and I'm thankful for that. But I know that there are people who will protect me. But people still want to take away the validity of the concern that Black Lives Matter. And this is one of those things, you know, you want all boats to rise, you know. And if you need me to explain, I'll be happy to do so as we talk. The phone number is 503-231-8187. And we got the kick signal that it's good, so we have a caller online. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Good.
You know, what I see, because I came out of the Deep South, and, you know, what Black people had to contend with back in the day down South, I think the Black people was more, I think, focused on racism because Black people was getting lynched. You know, that was overt racism. And I think right now, because racism come overt and covert, and I think right now the reason Black people can't really make the strides that Black people made back in the day is that Black people are not focused. They are splintered. You know, they'll go and fight for other people's causes, but those people's causes that they're fighting for, those people don't come back and participate and fight for Black causes. And I'm not going to name people, but that's a true fact. And also, don't be surprised if this guy that killed those people on the Max, don't be surprised if he don't get off, because he's already set the stage when he said, Portland, you have to get used to freedom of speech. Because what he was doing on that Max was exercising freedom of speech, and those other guys approached him, and he may have a self-defense. You may see that come out of this. So I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I see the groundwork already. So,
well, wait, hold on, Mike, because I want to say something about that, because you brought up a really important point, and that is the framing of it. But the framing is the second thing you did. I want to go back and say something about that first part you did about focus and the very real and present everyday danger of racism. Having been in the Deep South, I'm 100% understanding where you're coming from with that fear of everyday violence and not knowing when it's going to strike or if it's going to strike. And the biggest difference between, and it's been said so many times, and tell me what you think from being from the Deep South, is that it's right up in your face and you can identify it, but there are ground rules. In other words, I don't like you kind of people, but we got a job to do, let's get it done, and then you get out of my face and I'll get out of yours, you know. And you don't be here after dark and I won't be in your place after dark, but, you know, the lynchings and stuff occurred, but it was a real clear boundary of where the danger zone was. Nowadays, I mean, people have no idea what they can do. I was even reading an article talking about if you are a quote-unquote properly attired and dressed and respectable Black person, that doesn't mean that you're going to live the next day. I mean, coming from the South, what's your thought on that? Oh, Mike.
Hello?
Okay. Mike, well, call back. Go ahead, Cecil.
Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And we were talking about, how would you put it?
I said, how can we hold the fact that although the lives of the fallen men who were defending the young women of color are valid, Black Lives Matter?
So
and how we can keep that conversation going so we can stay helpful and supportive of each other.
So a couple of points that Mike made was, one is a reflection on the history of Black people in the South and in terms of their day-to-day existence. And I think it's also helpful to be very aware of the history of the Northwest
yes.
and Oregon. Very strange relationships. So when this territory was settled by white people and Oregon became a territory and subsequently a state at the time of the debate around slavery in the United States. So we were, the Oregon was accepted, came into the Union as a state that was not, where slavery was not allowed.
It was banned, yes.
It was slammed, but black people could not be here.
Right. Slavery was banned as well as black people. And by black people, I mean people of African ancestry.
So therefore, there's this strange and ongoing legacy of anti-black violence in this region, which was wedded into Oregon's constitution, which was not, I mean, it's very strange. So the fact that black people were not allowed to be here, and they had to not reside or own property in the state, that some of that was written in Oregon's constitution, which was not changed until the 1920s. And the most hideous language remained in Oregon's constitution until very recently, within the last 25 years, I think.
Right. I think the last vestiges and residue was removed in the 1980s or so.
And so there's this ongoing legacy of that. The other thing that Mike also raised is this, which I think is a very important and powerful point that we need to be aware of, is the use of free speech defense.
Yes.
And I think I'm hearing that in a lot of white, alt-right and white nationalist spaces, that I can say whatever I want to say, and that might be used as a defense in this upcoming case, but in many ways it is used as a way in which give me legitimacy to say hideous and which hideous things which may lead to very dangerous actions. That's something we have to be aware of, and I think that will cause many people concern.
Well, here's the thing that I find fascinating. We can find both in terms of popular culture and legislative will, a place to say yelling fire in a crowded theater is a problem. It's against the law. It's dangerous. Yet, using a word that has been designed for a macro aggression is allowed. And I understand that with human beings, because we have this libertarian little L bent, we don't want anything to govern our actions. We don't want any governors. You know, we want to be able to do whatever the world we want to do, when we want to do it, how we want to do it, etc. You know, so we use this excuse called the slippery slope to avoid having to make very difficult moral and ethical decisions. And so there is always room allowed to call a person whatever name is deemed appropriate for the moment and say, well, it's just words, as though that was an excuse. You know, we know better. But it's okay not to holler fire in a theater, because after all, human lives, you know, can be lost because of that fire. So, you know, that's one of those cognitive dissonances that we as human beings have to endure, and why it's really important to keep chiseling at whatever wall there is between us that keeps us from having an honest conversation. 503-231-8187. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Camilo. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm always tempted to say something in response to Mike's comments, But because he really annoys me, I find he's rather bigoted. I'm not going to speak to Mike except the one point that he made about the defense using freedom of speech. I think that's absurd. The defense will be self-defense. But let's leave that aside. The point that Mike did bring up that I want to address is the one of intersectionality, which he seems to leave out.
Mm-hmm.
He says that blacks are going to the defense of people where they should stay focused on the issue of blackness. And what he fails to understand is intersectionality. Blacks are of many different stripes. There is no uniform blackness. I myself am black, and I had an experience of intersectionality back in the 70s when I was a hippie. And my white hippie roommates claimed that hippies were suffering more discrimination than blacks, and of course that raised a controversy. But the particular intersectionality I want to raise today is about gay blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a similarity with gay blacks between what we saw with passing blacks who looked white.
Mm.
So blacks who look white really don't have to suffer the same kind of experience that blacks who don't look white. Likewise with gay black people, they don't have to suffer that discrimination against gays because gay is something that you don't really see.
Well, that you within certain parameters.
Let me continue what I have to say before you respond.
Okay, my bad.
I'm reading Radical Dharma.
Mm.
I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I've heard the title.
Well, you should be familiar with it. It's written by three gay Buddhists. I'm a straight black Buddhist. And the topic addresses the issue of trauma that they experience as gay people as well as black. Now, I'm very familiar with the issue of trauma as I am a psychiatrist. I'm also very familiar with gay people as I trained in Greenwich Village and I lived in Greenwich Village for 20 years. So it's something that I know intimately, but I don't have a grasp of the issue that gay blacks are raising because it's just something that I cannot relate to personally as a heterosexual person. And I would love to hear gay black people address this question so I can help to understand it better.
So what's the question?
The question is, as I tried to outline with the comparison with people who pass, the confrontation with the issue is something that could be easily avoided. So the trauma is not direct as it is with a difference that is apparent.
Okay.
Okay.
So I don't understand that personal experience of trauma that gay black people have been through because I have not been able to share it, although I have been involved with gay people and treated gay people and had social relations with gay people for much of my life.
So let me ask you to make sure I understand. So you raised the point of intersectionality, and you also, in terms of black people who are gay or queer, and you compare that to black people who pass as non-blacks, and so the trauma that black people who are gay who I'm still not unclear in terms of the challenges they faced in terms of their own realities of being black and gay or
are you asking to compare them? Because I mean I think I grasp it.
Listen to this. There was a sign at the demonstration yesterday. People of color cannot opt out.
Okay.
People who were gay can opt out. People who pass for white can opt out. They don't have to experience the trauma directly because they pass or they can pass. So what I'm asking is to have some personal understanding from a person who has been through this of the nature and manifestation of this kind of trauma that is articulated in radical dharma.
Well, I'm going to say this because we may not get to answer it, and I think that this is one of those where, Camillo, I believe you have officially volunteered to come on our show and have us cover this as a topic on the show with us, okay? Because I think that's a good question. I think it's a little off topic, but I think it's a good question because it does go right to that heart of that intersectionality, and the reason why I'm saying that it's very important for us to maintain the focus on Black Lives Matter. What I can say is that there are degrees of experience that you have garnered through your exposure and your communications with people who have had this trauma that will give you a lot more insight maybe than you are giving yourself credit for. This is why people suffer from secondhand post-traumatic stress disorder, especially empathetic people who are looking to make a connection with someone, whether it be a social connection or, you know, an intimate connection or an emotional connection, whatever it is, or a therapeutic connection. You know, once you make a connection with a person who's gone through this firsthand and you see some aspect of their life, you know, through your ability to connect with them, you're going to experience, albeit in an altered and diluted form, you're going to experience some of that trauma. Okay, so what I would suggest you do is do a little introspection on how you have addressed your experiences with secondhand trauma and look to that to give you a little bit more insight into what that feels. And just say, I think that you brought up a very valid point and why. And this, if people are listening, helps explain a little bit why for folks of color, especially Black people, it is so hard to escape this, I'm going to borrow a phrase, sunken place, because it comes at you from so many different directions. Does that make sense?
Well, not yet, but I'll think about it.
Okay. And I'm serious about having you come on the show and us talk about this because I think you're bringing up a very important point, especially since for everybody else, gender is seeming to disappear, but not if you are a non-conforming gender Black person.
Well, I'm in a Buddhist book group that's reading Radical Dharma now, and I've offered to speak about a piece on healing and love by one of the authors, and that is the subject I'm trying to comprehend a little bit better, and when I do, I would be happy to come on the show and talk about it.
Thank you so much, Camilo. Thank
yes.
you for being you and for giving us a conversation this morning.
Okay.
Let's go to our next caller. Good morning.
Thank you for waiting. Okay, is it Michael?
Yeah.
Okay, we weren't sure which Michael it was. Welcome.
Okay, hi. Let me get you off the speakerphone.
Okay.
Hi. So I've participated in a fair number of conversations like this at the college where I teach, and I've talked to you guys occasionally, but often what happens is it's like you all of a sudden get mad at me and you hang up and so I'm trying again, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, I'm glad we keep trying.
Okay. So you said something about the history of Oregon that has to be talked about. Remember about maybe 10 minutes ago?
Okay. Yes. So what was your question? Yes, I remember.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. So then what? My question is, then what? I mean, I don't go around looking for Black people to persecute, and yet, you know, I hear all this stuff about, well, the racist history of Oregon, where I didn't live until, you know, in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And, like, so then what? So So I know what happened with the Constitution and all of that, but it doesn't seem like there's any application of it. What would I do that's different because I found out about that history? I'm still not looking for anybody to persecute.
Okay. One reason I raised it, because I think we have a tendency to personalize issues such as race and gender, so that I think in popular culture, racism has evolved to mean how one person might feel. And the reason I raised the issue of Oregon's history was to remind us that racism is institutional, it's embedded in our society, and how it's manifested in our region is based upon our history. So that I think in order to more accurately address racism, we need to understand our history and what that means for the way we carry our lives. So that you who arrived in this region in the 80s, I arrived in this region in the 80s, I must understand how it continues to play out in our everyday world. So certainly not, the Constitution has been changed, et cetera, but embedded in our society is this tendency to view things differently, or view peoples or groups differently, so that one of the way it's manifested in our society today is that history that this region was a white homeland, and it plays out in many different ways in terms of economics, in terms of regions, in terms of people, how they evolve. So what you and I can do as people who may not be native to this region is understand that that it plays a role on the ongoing legacy in the way in which people interact.
Well, you know, it's so vague and nonspecific.
I can give you a couple of specifics, but okay. Here's the problem. There is no one specific, and even if we could nail it, it morphs because people's defense mechanisms, when they feel that they are about to be devalued, morph. The reason that there were no slaves or free blacks allowed in this state was to make sure that a white man's labor was not devalued. So there was a fear of competition built in to the legislative structure of this state. It manifests itself in ways like this. Rather than look at ways that all long-term residents, especially low-income and especially minority residents in neighborhoods in Northeast and North Portland, could stay in their property, you know, and experiment with things like grandfathering in taxes or what have you, property taxes, so people didn't have to lose their homes. The free market turned a blind eye to the pillaging of the black and low-income Portland neighborhoods and allowed people to be pushed out. And then they turned around later and said, oh, mea culpa, come back. Here's a pittance of money to pretend like we're going to salve your conscience and our conscience. But we look at that, and only somebody who is really naive would say that was a well-thought-out compassionate plan. They would say, nope, it was a capitalistic money-making venture. No one in their right mind would say that the way that the Max line has been secured, for want of a better word, by targeting low-income folks of color who depend on the MAC's work, and not all of the people who try to escape and get a free ride are criminals in the classic sense. You know, they're targeting low-income people and giving them tickets rather than actually addressing the real security issues. Okay, that's another way in which race plays out, or the fact that when it comes to looking at traffic stops, when it comes to looking at housing discrimination, when it comes to health disparities, regardless of the silo, you will find that blacks in Oregon are always on the bottom. Okay, that's one of the ways very directly and concretely in which all of this stuff plays out. So what can you do? Well, you, for example, could write a letter when you read an article in the Oregonian that doesn't do diligence or justice to a situation and ask for a better level of reporting. Or when you see comments or hear comments made in electronic media on the television, you could write in and make a comment. When you hear conversation amongst your friends and family and associates, you could straighten out the situation, and then you could read more and talk to more people so you get a better idea of what it is we're looking for. I mean, that's a good start. That's a concrete start. Pick one or two things and just stick with them.
Well, you know, I've tried that, but what I run into is that then when the conversation starts, what the person of color, such as you, says, I don't agree with every single thing.
Well, okay.
And so when I raise those things,
that's the conversation we start with. We're not going any further until we understand why you don't agree, and that would be the conversation where we start.
Well, okay, I've tried it a number of times,
and you might have to keep trying, because what might be happening, Michael. And I'm not sure if you're one of the folks that I've actually had the conversation where I said, I don't want to talk to you anymore on the air.
Oh,
is
yeah.
You might hit an intractable situation where you are not trying to see the situation through my eyes.
Well, let me just tell you the most recent
Okay,
example.
30 seconds, and then yeah, we got another caller backed up.
I said something about how I teach computer science, and we don't get hardly any black students. And you got really mad at me at that point and said, and why do you think that is? And I said, I don't know. And you said, you don't know, huh? And you hung up on me. And
okay,
like,
this is what you need to do. Okay, go to the few black students you have and talk to them. Maybe you might even put an ad in on Craigslist and interview people and ask them, why don't they come to this school? That's what you can do. That's how you can start.
Oh, well, you know, I also could have started if you wanted to tell me, but you just got mad at me.
Well, you know, I think we had gotten off topic, and
okay.
I'm a human being that suffers in a lot of ways that I don't feel like going into right now. And my point is to try to keep conversation. So sometimes what I do is a mic drop and walk away. That way you and I can talk another day,
okay.
Which is part of what this whole conversation is talking about. So we've gotten to a good point. You've got a place, I've got a place, I know what my homework is, you know what your homework is, and we start from there. But the good thing is, we're still talking.
Well, fair enough. I'm not perfect either. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our numbers, this is, at KBOO, your community radio station.
Yes.
Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Let's go to our next caller. Good morning, Francis.
Good morning.
Hi. There's persecution and then there's persecution. I'm not quite sure where to begin. I hope you let me ramble a little bit. But I just got off the phone with my youngest son. My children are African American, and we were talking about all this. He calls me every week or two, and we talk in the mornings about the world. He is of a mind that the man who did this is ill. And I agree. People have commented that he seemed like he was on a meth trip. And I agree. And what is happening right now is people in those states of mind who may have racist tendencies have been given the green light by the grand whistleblower to go ahead and act it out. And they're not in their right minds. A lot of them are not. They're tweaking.
Can I jump in here and say something real quick on that, Francis?
As a mother of African-American children and grandchildren, their lives matter more to me than anything else in this world. And executions are happening today. Lynchings are not happening in the South last year. They're happening today in Portland, Oregon, in Pittsburgh, in New York City, everywhere. And they're being sanctioned, and they're done by law enforcement. When a young man is on his knees and gets executed by a man holding a great big rifle because he doesn't stand upright, but this man who just got through killing people with his knife, is flaying his knife around, blood all over him, screaming, "Go ahead and kill me," somehow they manage not to kill him.
Right.
If people can't see the difference there, then there's a problem. When my young son was 12 years old and two blocks from home, he and his friends were made to get on their knees with guns pointed at their back and told to put their hands on their heads and walk backwards. And when I went to find out what happened, there is no record that the incident even occurred. Then that means to me that those children's lives meant nothing to anyone except me and the people that love them. And if people can't understand that and can't see what is going on right now and how these people who have, some of them are not in their right mind, some of them are high on meth, but somehow feel that they have permission to talk to a little girl like that man did on the train, and that's okay, that's freedom of speech, then there's something seriously wrong here. And for the president of this country to act like that's nothing and not even make a statement about how these people are acting, that's something. The young man who survived the Max trip,
yes,
he said, it's amazing. He said, it's beautiful how so much money has been donated to him and to the families of those men who were killed. But he said, but what about the little girl? He said, she's been traumatized for the rest of her life. She needs people's help. That child needs people's help. And I don't understand how people can't see this and where their heads are. It's pretty sad to me.
Well, thank you, Francis. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I'll let your words speak for themselves,
yes,
and
right,
and let people think about it, and you know, continue to love your children and grandchildren, and
I love to make sure
that they know that they are worthy.
You know, I feel that anybody that blows themselves up for whatever reason to kill other people has lost their mind also.
Yeah.
You know, they've been through some kind of trauma that is, you know, and some of these young people now that they're calling terrorists are in their early 20s.
They're being exploited.
10, 15 years ago when they were teenagers, their families were blown up by somebody's bomb. I mean, you know, people need to think about this. If you want terrorism to stop, then you need to stop terrorizing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You guys take care.
You too. One of the things I want to say with regard to the idea of mental health and substance use and racism. Racism in and of itself is an aberrant mental state. It is a form of mental illness. People who especially hold virulent racist views are in the midst of a thought disorder. So that in and of itself is a mental health issue. However, here's the thing. Just like anyone who has to do any kind of really conscience-searing work will tell you, sometimes you get into an altered state to allow you to reach that height of anger. I mean, you know, the Nazis would give their soldiers amphetamines so that they could reach that berserker high. And for him to use methamphetamine and do these things is part of that whole mindset and part of the Nazi culture. So there is no excuse. There is no hiding place in the use of drugs with racism. And we need to look at that and call it out. It is not allowed as an excuse. What it is it is both a mental health issue, and it's still a crime. I know this is more conversation than, you know, 40 minutes can allow. So it's the kind of thing that we've said earlier is going to be ongoing. We're going to try and get to our next callers, 503-231-8187. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. A couple things. Going back to the gentleman, Michael, who was...
Which Michael? Sounds,
I was just going to say the one who sounded a little bit like he's interested in dialogue, but also like he's not really hearing.
Okay,
the second one. From folks of color.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I just wanted to say on that note that for everybody, we enjoy some kind of privilege, especially if we live in this country, and that privilege is invisible to the people who enjoy it. And so, you know, we all have to understand that we don't know other people's experiences because we don't have them. And so when we're talking to people who are different from us, for me as a cisgender, as a straight man, I have to listen when queer people are speaking about their issues because I don't understand. So I have to be a listener. And then when issues that I do have the authority by experience to speak to come up, then I can interject my voice. And so my advice, Michael, to you would be to listen and to learn from what you hear, and not listen from your own lens, but listen from the perspective of the other person. And really seek to understand, because they probably wouldn't be telling you things about their own experiences of oppression if they didn't really believe that their experiences were real and valid. And so we have to offer that same belief. And then once we listen, we can learn from that. And then that's what prepares us to serve other people who are different. And so listen, learn, and serve. And just because one person doesn't want to talk, maybe you wore Celeste out and she doesn't want to talk to you, but that doesn't mean that the conversation ends. There are other people of color and there are other people in different places who may be more willing to share than other people. This is a tiring, exhausting process to constantly have to explain how racism operates to the people who perpetuate racism. So you just have to understand that you're not always going to be talking to happy folks that are just perfectly willing to answer all of your questions until you come to an understanding. You got to do some of that work yourself, and you have to understand that sometimes we're just tired. We don't want to talk about it. And I really appreciate your talk on that, Celeste, and thank you for staying in this and keeping the dialogue open. To the bigger question of how do we do this, the last caller actually spoke to this. Micah Fletcher, the surviving victim of the attack, has really done an incredible job of, you know, somebody wrote All Lives Matter in chalk by the train station. He took a picture of it and posted it, and he said, this is what I'm talking about. This is not what this is about. This is he's like, Black Lives Matter, period. Say it. And he said, if somebody doesn't go down there and remove that, I will go down there and do it myself. And so he is using his life and his breath and his voice to really point to what the issue is. He pointed out the problem here in Portland with this white savior complex, that more money is going to the victims who passed and their families and to him as a survivor than attention and finances have been going to the two girls who were the whole reason this happened, because they were targeted. And so he's been able to call that out and to name that in a way that's been both really humbling and also really inspiring. And so I think, you know, seeing him as using his voice as a true ally, I think for white folks in Portland, they need to look to Micah Fletcher as the way forward. And for us as people of color, we just have to keep on listening to folks who are different from us. You know, for cisgender people of color in the Black community, we have to listen to queer folks of color and their experiences and learn from what they're saying and stand shoulder to shoulder when they need us and when they ask us. And the same goes for all of us, no matter where we come from. So that's my two cents.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you so much, because hearing your words really are a salve to my spirit. I'm all serious. Right. You said everything we needed to say. Thank you.
Thank you. You guys keep doing what you're doing.
So, as we continue on our journey to a world which begins to look like justice. We need to continue speaking with one another, and we need to not give up the struggle.
Though self-care is important, listening is very important, believing. We have, Cecil and I talked a lot of times about maybe having a More Talk radio forum outside of the studio, and I'm going to have a conversation with him and our intrepid news director, Derek Crooks, to see about maybe making that happen, because this is one of those times and situations where a good dialogue is, my goodness, it is ointment to the soul.
So stay tuned here on your community radio station for more talk. Up next is the OMO Variety Hour. Until we speak with you again, I'm Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and this is your community connection, KBOO Portland.
You are listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland.
Worry, I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some hope.
Dearly beloved,
yes, come ride and dance with Diablo all around Portland as we celebrate Prince's birthday on Wednesday, June 7th at 8 p.m. with a mobile bicycle dance party. We'll be rocking Petalpalooza, dropping the Prince jams all night long, frequent dance stops. Once again, that's Prince's birthday celebration on Wednesday, June 7th, 8 p.m. More information on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Coming to the radio airwaves on Monday, June 5th at 11 p.m. The Ubu Hour Radio Western, Kill Faster Pussycat.
I don't care for the way you girls get your thrills. Enough is enough. Now give it back or...